Welcome back to Putting It Together, the podcast that discusses Stephen Sondheim's entire body of work chronologically, show by show, and song by song. Currently, we're at the very beginning of his career and talking about West Side Story. In this episode, I invited Nick Driscoll to discuss Something's Coming, the first song sung by the character Tony. I wanted Nick on the podcast because of his background. He went to school for musical theater specifically, and I knew he'd bring a perspective that I don't have about Sondheim, the actual performing of it. You'll also see in our conversation that even at this stage of his career, Stephen Sondheim was very conscious of how character and song needed to complement each other. So let's go to that conversation now about the music and lyrics of Something's Coming from West Side Story.
Could be, who knows? There's something due any day. I will know right away, soon as it shows.
So Nick Driscoll, thank you so much for joining me.
No problem.
All my pleasure really here today. What we like to start off with here is I think it's probably a good idea for you to introduce yourself and maybe a little bit of background about the stuff that you know about Sondheim.
Sure. Well, my name's Nick Driscoll. I have been involved in musical theater, I guess, ever since I was 5 years old, starting with my first community theater production as Fester the Jester.
Amazing.
And it grew and grew to an obsession, and I kept training with TheaterWorks Alberta, which was based here in Calgary, and then eventually through Summerstock, who I first got interested in Summerstock after walking by Olympic Plaza one day and seeing a production of West Side Story playing.
Wow.
And I had never really dove into West Side Story specifically until seeing that. And I thought the production was so good. It was not your typical high school university theater experience. It was so good. And so I knew after I saw Summerstock's production of West Side Story that I needed to do that. And so I did end up joining a couple of years later and doing Rent with them, and then kept doing that for, I did 5 years in Summerstock until it ended its last year with Legally Blonde. That was back in 2012. And I was still obsessed. So I went to school for musical theater.
Nice.
I received a scholarship for Missouri State University. So I got my BFA musical theater, graduated in 4 years, and that's pretty much my story up till this point. So
I love it. You have a huge pedigree here and a huge knowledge of musical theater in general, and I'm glad that I can have you here on the podcast to like talk about this a little bit more more in depth than I've ever been able to before. I guess when we talk about Stephen Sondheim in general, I know that sometimes he's fabled in musical theater as being like, yeah, we love when we get to do a Sondheim show. Can you kind of verbalize why that is?
Of course, yeah. I think part of the reason why actors specifically like performing Sondheim mm-hmm. pieces is because they're so conversational, right? There's sometimes, especially if you take a look at some of the older musical theater, even like Frank Lesser and everything, it's kind of conceptual. I know these were the songs that were made into popular songs by, you know, Frank Sinatra, Judy Garland, and everything. And they were good songs, but they were also kind of what you would hear on the radio today almost. They would be, you know, kind of maybe relating to someone, but I mean, Sondheim songs are very, very conversational. If you take a look even at, say, for instance, Anyone Can Whistle, right?
Mm-hmm.
That show, if you take a look at Everybody Says Don't, it's very active. There's actions that can be applied to everything, right? Talking about Make Just a Ripple, Come On Be Brave. This time a ripple, next time a wave. Sometimes you have to start small. Climbing the tiniest wall, maybe you're going to fall. But, you know, it's so conversational. It's so direct, and you're talking to someone specifically. And that's always the big thing with actors. They want to be speaking to an other. We want to be conversing. Even if it's a soliloquy, maybe if we're singing something from West Side Story, whether it's Maria, maybe we're not necessarily singing to Maria, but we're not singing to an audience, right? That's not the character's reality, right? We're singing.
There's an internal turmoil that's inside of you that's making you want to shout that name out.
Yeah. Who are we talking to? Are we talking to an inner version of ourselves? Are we talking to our best friend? Are we talking to our best friend as if they were there, but maybe they're not? It's very complicated, but I think Sondheim's lyrics and music specifically makes it very easy, especially because the music matches the lyrics so well.
Right.
When you think about, you know, normal musical theater writing, the reason why we consider it to be such a challenge, the reason why we think it's so juicy, and yes, we want to do a Sondheim show, is because so many of those musical intervals are not, right, your typical fifth intervals. It's, right, six, or, it's just very, you know, sixths and sevenths, and it's beautiful music, and the reflection of the character's reality is reflected in that music. And that's, I think, what makes me appreciate Sondheim so much.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I really do feel, even though in West Side Story, Sondheim is not writing the music to it, mm-hmm. and we had a great conversation with Joseph LeBay in our last episode about that. But when you get into those shows that he did write the music for, the music by itself is beautiful.
Yes.
I think in West Side Story, the music by itself is even beautiful. It matches what the character is singing about.
Exactly.
And you know, you also mentioned like the shows by Frank Lesser and that sort of thing. Not to go too far into the weeds, but I always love to make the joke about how in Camelot they kind of just gave up and have that song at the very end that says, by the way, here's how the whole story ends, and now we're gonna end the show. It's like, yeah. I don't think anything like that would ever happen in a Sondheim show.
No,
it would just make no sense whatsoever.
It has to be very intentional.
So we last left off, you know, we open up West Side Story by the music first. Like, we really wanted to see that this show is not just about music and lyrics, but it's about music and dance as well. And we're mm-hmm. introduced to the Jets and to the Sharks, and we see through dance specifically how these two groups are interacting with one another. And then we have the Jet song that we talked about in our last episode about how this is really seeing how these people, or these kids, are probably from not very good homes, and they're trying to make it here in the world. So we go from there. I'm just going to read this out from Wikipedia. But the Jets leader, Riff, suggests setting up a rumble with the Sharks. He plans to make the challenge to Bernardo, the Sharks' leader, that night at the neighborhood dance. Riff wants to convince his friend and former member of the Jets, Tony, to meet the Jets at the dance. Some of the Jets are unsure of his loyalty, but Riff is adamant that Tony is still one of them. Riff meets Tony while he's working at Doc's drugstore to persuade him to come. Tony initially refuses, but Riff wins him over. Tony is convinced that something important is around the corner. That kind of leads right into this song. There is this moment, at least in the book of the musical itself, of we see Riff and Tony talking, and we see that Tony has kind of decided he's done with this gang life. He doesn't really want to be in that group anymore, and he's trying to prove himself. So right from the very beginning, we kind of know that that's where the character is starting from. And then we launch into this. So I'm going to open up this book that we've been using called Finishing the Hat, where all the lyrics are printed here very nicely for me. So Riff kind of walks away, and Tony's there by himself, still at the drugstore. And he opens up, could be, who knows, there's something due any day. I will know right away, soon as it shows. It may come cannonballing down from the sky, gleam in its eye, bright as a rose, who knows? So he's kind of asking questions. He's not quite sure. He's in this situation where he thinks that there is something coming. And I'd like to know from you, right from the very beginning, he knows there feels that there's something coming. He's asking questions like, is there something coming? As someone who has actually studied this, how did you go about studying this song?
I think it's important to remember that Tony has this kind of bubbling up inside of him where, yes, he's just had this conversation with Riff and says, you know, tomb to womb, sperm to worm, and
right.
kind of getting back in. And Riff is 100% all in. He's like, oh, yeah, I'll see Tony at the dance. No problem. Right. Mm-hmm. But we get to see a little bit of Tony contemplating maybe something out there is better. Right. He's going to leave the gang life behind, and he knows that there's something better, but doesn't know what. Of course, you know, we go back to the story of Romeo and Juliet. Of course, that's foreshadowing. But at the same time, it's such a wonderful piece because the lyrics allow us to see a little bit of the inside of Tony's brain and see how he's going to take all of this information that he's been given from Riff and really allow the next thing to happen, which is, of course, as we find out, meeting Maria at the dance at the
right,
gym.
Right. I mean, what it really feels like for me, I mean, we talked about this in our last episode too, where these characters are really, their analogs are in Shakespeare and in Romeo and Juliet, which is, this is kind of an adaptation of, but these are teenagers. These are supposed to be teenagers, and they feel like, hey, the whole world is in front of me right now. And to me, it feels like this is graduation day almost. It's like, hey, I've graduated this life, and now everything that I want is just up ahead of me, and I know that there's something out there in front of me. I just don't know what it is yet. Mm-hmm. I have some hopes, but I don't know what it is yet. So he continues on. It's only just out of reach, down the block, on a beach, under a tree. I got a feeling there's a miracle due, gonna come true, coming to me. So now we're getting into that aspirational feelings that there's something from somewhere. He just has to go and find it. I like some of the imagery. I want to pull out some of the imagery here, because right now we're looking at like trees, beaches, miracles that he's talking about. And in a future episode, when we talk about the song Maria, what I like to draw out from there is that there is a little bit of Christian imagery coming from there as well. Like, Maria is definitely portrayed as kind of this Virgin Mary type character.
Yeah.
Inside the piece. And even from here, we have those things like miracles and something that's due and something that's going to be wondrous coming out here for us, which I think really does point to Tony being this dreamer of a character, which is really nice that Sondheim is able to even see that into this song. Do you still have your notes for when you studied this song at all?
Oh, I sure do. Yeah. This is my sophomore year, my second year in musical theater workshop, when we were really talking about acting the song. Mm-hmm. And actually, come to think of it, so many of us chose songs. I know, of course, just the lyrics in this case are by Sondheim, but so many of us chose Sondheim pieces because they are so actable and they're fantastic pieces, but above all, they give us an excellent other and excellent imagery, and they're very active. And in this case, of course, you know, when Sondheim was writing the song, they kind of decided that they wanted it to be something like Julie Garden, you know,
forget your troubles,
come on, get happy, but in a very different way. It's a very different song.
Oh, for sure.
It's not a traditional musical theater song. It's something that you don't necessarily leave humming as you leave the theater.
Yeah.
But it's so wonderful. And I remember specifically, I had to find a way, our teacher said, we have to find a way to relate it to ourselves. And so I approached it as the way when I did when I actually left Apple the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had just, essentially, I was had been offered a promotion at that job. And I also, at the time, had auditioned for Missouri State University, and I had to decide. I was admitted, and I had to decide, what do I do? I could keep going on the same page that I have been on, or I could leave and do something that I'm very passionate about. I don't know what it's going to be like. I've never even been there.
Right.
I've never even been to that state or been to that city. But I know that that's something that really excites me. I didn't know what was in store. I had no idea about the people there, no idea about the architecture, other than photos and talking to people over the phone and online in my audition. But I could feel something, that it was the right choice. And I really had to be introspective about that. And I think that's what allowed me to connect to this song. It seemed to be like it was a similar decision between Tony leaving the gang of teens and then eventually going to this dance and meeting Maria.
I mean, Apple and 1950 street gangs are very similar.
Very similar, so. Yes.
Sorry, that brings up another question here for me. Did you audition online, like through like Skype or something?
Yes,
like that?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, that would have been terrifying.
I know, it is terrifying. I agree.
Like in your room, or did you go somewhere?
It was in my childhood home office.
Oh man.
So okay. We had the computer there with the webcam and everything, right? Because this is old school. This is like EMAC days.
Right.
So had to have the separate webcam. But yes, that was the best space. That was where I recorded all my videos.
That's amazing.
I'm sure it drove my mom nuts, but that's where it was.
That's cool. I'm going to have some more questions about that coming up. But Tony continues, could it be? Yes, it could. Something's coming, something good. If I can wait, something's coming. I don't know what it is, but it is going to be great. I love this optimism from him. It's like, something's coming. And of course, we've just mentioned here that this is absolute foreshadowing. Mm-hmm. This is like the rise before the fall. We know, having seen this and knowing Romeo and Juliet, that this has kind of a very tragic ending. It's going to end in a very somber way. But right now, at the beginning of the piece, at least, it's like, yeah, there's this thing that's going to happen, and I know it's going to be great. Even though, as we as an audience know, it's probably not going to be so great.
Yeah.
And Sondheim likes to use this kind of like dramatic irony a lot of times, or he likes to use wordplay too. Not so much in this particular song, but I love how he's able to use pieces of music in vastly different ways, which is bringing up a theme or something at the very beginning of the show, and then using that same theme, but having it mean something completely different by the end of the show. which we'll get into as we kind of continue through his huge body of work here on the show. There's some, what from an English degree, I know are kind of like an onomatopoeia or at least visual imagery that he's using. Because in this next stanza, it goes, with a click, with a shock, phonal jingle, doral knock, open the latch. Something's coming, don't know when, but it's soon. Catch the moon, one-handed catch. So there's a lot of those like hard consonants that are happening here, kind of evoking that imagery. And this is something Sondheim has actually mentioned before, but there's a lot of this baseball imagery being thrown into here. And I guess my question to you then would be, this feels like it's backstory in quotes, but not like overtly so. We're not saying that Tony is like, I absolutely was a baseball player and I'm going to sing about it. This isn't Damn Yankees or something like that. But it is something that's there. It's peppered in. It's like, well, okay, this kid probably has some sort of background in baseball.
Yeah. Well, I actually kind of drawn on that a little bit because it's interesting. 2 months prior, I had actually done Damn Yankees at 10th Meter.
Okay.
So it was funny getting to revisit all the baseball imagery, like one-handed catch, right? Cannonballing down from the sky. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating to think about because the imagery allows an actor to almost embody that, those actions, right? You know what it feels like from playing baseball before to feel something and have it hit you in the chest or, you know, reach up and try to reach something. It's, I think, the lyrics evoking baseball imagery are even more helpful to the actor because it's almost begging for those huge, grandiose actions to happen. And of course, that's the best when you can be an actor and be open and honest with your body language. That's something that's every actor looks for in all their songs.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that I failed to mention here at the very beginning, we are looking at the show through the lens of three different iterations of the same material, which is the original Broadway cast, the movie version, and then the 2009 revival. And there's three singers who have interpreted this song. The original Broadway has Larry Kurt. The movie, even though the actor is Richard Boehmer, it's actually sung by Jimmy Bryant. And then the 2009 revival is Matt Kavanaugh. And definitely this song is interpreted in a few different ways where we were talking right before this started. This is a song, when Larry Kurt interpreted it, it feels like a very personal song. He's not necessarily like trying to hit the rafters or trying to be like an operatic interpretation of this song. And I think that works a little bit because I think it's like, I know there's something coming, but maybe not. Like with his body language is kind of saying, well, maybe there isn't something. And I'm going to bring that up when the very last line comes up. We transfer that into the movie version, which, because it's the movie version, they don't have to be singing that out as loudly. So it's a smaller song. It's a quieter song because it's a screen that's separating us and the audience. But then finally we have Matt Kavanaugh interpret it, and now it does turn into almost like a mini opera that he likes to do it. He likes to hit those high notes as much as he can. So I like hearing those three different interpretations. Mm-hmm. I had this conversation with Joe Slabay in the last episode about when you put on one of these performances, you absolutely have to stick like, these are the notes, these are the lyrics, we cannot stray from that. Yet at the same time, you as an actor, how do you go about that interpretation? Like, how far can you take your interpretation?
Yeah, it's a great question. I remember because I actually had a chance to see the Broadway revival. It was after they had done the changes back from changing some of the Spanish lyrics back into English. So I wish I would have gotten to see the actual original version. But I remember people were talking about Matt Kavanaugh's performance as being too subdued, too gentle. And I guess I kind of felt that when I saw it, but then you go back and you watch videos of Larry Kurt singing it, and it was even more so. Mm-hmm. It's not a huge dramatic song. I think that's sometimes, at least I agree with the interpretation that if you're in that kind of a space, your emotions kind of necessitate some sort of movement, some sort of action, but it doesn't need to be huge. So I don't think it's a huge song. That being said, certain actors like to make it a huge song, which is totally fine, right? Every actor has their own interpretation. Some actors, the A at the end, they like to keep it in falsetto and very soft and they fade it out. And some actors like to make it a big belty high note with a big orchestral finish and a big downbeat at the end.
Yeah.
And I enjoy both versions, to be honest with you. But I think my personal preference is to keep it a little bit more subdued at the end, because you can kind of hear it in the music, right? In Leonard Bernstein's music, you kind of hear dun 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 dun, like it's very, it kind of fades away, and it's leading you into the next scene, mm-hmm. and it's leading you into Tony's next thoughts, where he just kind of starts at he ends the song in the same spot that he started, really.
Yeah.
When you think about it, which is so interesting, because you talk about musical theater songs being a progression. I think we get to see so much character development in that song, but at the same time, he still has that energy when he ends the song. Whereas if you do the version where it's a big belty high note and it ends in a huge orchestral finish, it's like, yes, I've made my decision. This is exactly, I know what's coming.
Yeah.
This is what's next. But he doesn't.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. No, I think we should talk a little bit about that orchestration underneath it, because even those like dun 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 that happens at the very beginning, it does feel like it's like I have nervous anticipation that, mm-hmm. that's going on. And how it's usually interpreted is like he'll go on runs that are like going up in octaves, right? It's like one-handed catch, like he's going up high, and then it goes down quiet then right after that really, really quickly. So it's like he's like letting himself be like taken over by this thing that might be coming for him, and then he's immediately back in himself and it's quiet again. So I like how that the song actually has this kind of dramatic tension going on throughout it, where it's like I'm going to sing and belt this out, and then no, bam, I'm down in my lower register again.
Yeah, and I think the amount of times, this is something that when I was working on this song with my voice teacher, this is something that she kept saying, every time you say the word something's coming, has to be different, right? Mm. I don't know how, I mean, you could probably count them, but
yeah,
the phrase something's coming is said a lot in this song. So why is it said a lot? It has a purpose, and every single time it's said, it has to be looking for something different. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It feels almost a little bit circular until you dissect it into the different beats, and you can say, oh, okay, like at this point, Tony really isn't sure. And at this point, you know, in the second, I guess you would call it the second verse, mm-hmm. the second stanza, it starts to get a little bit more concrete. Like you said, harder consonants. Maybe he's getting a little bit closer to the answer. Then at the end, it kind of fades away again, but he's still saying something's coming, right? Maybe tonight. And so how does each of those phrases become different each time he says it?
Right. Oh, I love it. So we continue on, and it's like, around the corner or whistling down the river, come on, deliver to me. Will it be? Yes, it will. Maybe just by holding still, it'll be there. Come on, something. Come on in. Don't be shy. Meet a guy. Pull up a chair. What I really want to pull out about this verse specifically is how definitely Sondheim does this, where it's like, yes, it will. Maybe. Is like the next word that he says right after that line, where there's still that reticence that says like, yes, it absolutely is. Well, maybe not.
It's just such a Sondheim thing to do. But at mm-hmm. the same time, it's such great stuff for an actor, because when you're going through and you're scoring a song, you want to find the beat changes. It's right there,
mm-hmm.
right? Yes, it will. Maybe. Double line slash maybe, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so you can actively use that to influence your actions as an actor.
Yeah. So then we ended off by saying, the air is humming and something great is coming. Who knows? It's only just out of reach, down the block, on the beach, maybe tonight. And then you say that ends off in an A, and I'll believe you that that's the note that he sings. One of the things before we wrap up this is that I want to read the notes that Sondheim actually writes after this song, where he says, and I should do some backstory here. Sondheim goes on at length in this book about how he doesn't really love poetic language, mm-hmm. like I'll say capital P poetic language. He thinks that people should be direct and just say what they mean and only use poetry in very specific instances. But he writes here, some of the images here may seem poetic in the way I deplore, but I would claim that they are the expression of an inarticulate, excited young man. They are not measured, they are not written, which is another thing he doesn't like. He doesn't like it when the songwriter like shows off and like, I can tell that someone wrote that and thought they were super clever about writing that sort of thing. But I think that he kind of underscores what we've been talking about here. This is an excited young man who thinks he knows what's coming up, but maybe he doesn't actually know what's coming up.
Yeah. I mean, that happens all the time when we daydream, when we get really excited about something, you get obsessed with it almost. At least
absolutely.
I do.
No, for sure.
You start researching it, and you start dreaming about it, and it shows up in your dreams, and you start to see, I forget what the exact scientific term is, but basically you see this thing now all the time, right? If you're obsessed about a certain car model, or you've been shopping for a car and you test drive one, you're now going to see that on every single street corner, mm-hmm. right? It's not because they're on necessarily every single street corner, but now all of a sudden your brain is looking for it. I think that's exactly what Tony's doing in this song. You can say, I mean, he's repeating the same thing. Something's coming. And as he goes through, yes, the images might seem poetic, but it's because he's absolutely obsessed with this concept. He's daydreaming, exactly like you said.
And one last call out to it, at least in the Larry Kurt version, what I like about that kind of at the end, it's like he goes, something great, and then immediately he goes down, is coming. Like he almost whispers it in his rendition. And I've always loved that moment specifically in the song because it feels like he's about to come to this great conclusion and then kind of falls off there again. And then that last note, which we've kind of discussed in the Larry Kurt and kind of in the movie version too, it's a very quiet moment at the end. He's trailing off and almost going down, whereas the Matt Cavanaugh in the revival version, he belts it. Like he goes as high as he can.
Yeah.
And I remember that throwing me off the very first time I heard, like, wait a second, what are you doing? Again, different interpretations, and I love the fact that actors can give those different interpretations. Myself, I think mostly because of nostalgia, I prefer the Larry Kurt version because that's the first one I was introduced to.
Yeah. Well, I wonder how much of that decision too is Arthur Lawrence, right?
True.
Directing the show. Yeah. Because if you think about it, I mean, that's what was so neat about that revival, right? Mm-hmm. Is that Arthur Lawrence was still directing this revival. And so where was that decision made? Was it a collaboration between Matt Cavanaugh and Arthur Lawrence? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I'd love to know a little bit more about that. But it sounds great. And the first time I heard it, I think each version can kind of stand on its own.
Oh, sure.
But at the same time, I seem to really enjoy his performance of it too.
Yeah, great. Now comes some of the other questions that I have. There's this great documentary that HBO made called Six by Sondheim. And in it, they do talk about this song specifically. And some things I like to pull out from there. Number one, how these shows and Broadway change over time and are really tested a whole lot before you actually see the finished version. Because this was something that was added in during rehearsals of the show. So this was not something that was written before that the characters and the actors were performing. And they realized that something that wasn't working very well is that the first time we see Tony, he doesn't have this weight. There isn't this like dramatic flourish of him being able to carry the rest of the show with him. Mm-hmm. And Sondheim was like, we need a song to put into there. And like you said, it's like, it needs to be something like a Judy Garland song, but of course of our own making. Wrote this in a day, apparently. He wrote this song in a day. And I love him talking about it because he woke up Oscar Hammerstein's wife for her to listen to it.
Okay. Which she's tired.
And she's like,
that's fine.
It's great. And she went back to bed, which I love that kind of mental imagery that was going. I was like, yeah, keep writing your show, Steve. It's great. And then when they performed it for the very first time in Washington, apparently it like stopped the show. Like everyone like just loved how it was performed, which then gave Larry Kurt the confidence to be like, yes, I can actually carry this Broadway show when we go back to New York.
Yeah, I think the development of it is interesting because Sondheim also said, I believe in that same documentary, that the reason why the songs that he seems to add to shows are the ones that become the hits, if you will, is because he gets to write them for that specific character, for that specific actor, after he's seen the show up on its feet. It's no longer pages on a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. It's now living, breathing. He's able to see the set. He's able to see the actor. He's able to see how the show flows. And I think there's something to be said for how a show flows. The amount of shows I've been in that have completely had drastic changes to them, even if it's a remounted production or an original work, doing both, the playwright may change something, the lyricist may change something, the composer may change something, the director might change an entire thing. I've had massive changes happen to shows halfway through the run because an audience isn't picking up on something.
Right.
And so I think the fact that he was able to write it specifically for Larry Kurt, this was his first big Broadway show, and maybe if it had been someone who playing Tony, who had a lot of Broadway pedigree, maybe he wouldn't have needed that song. Maybe it would never have been written. And look how it turned out.
Which is fascinating because in like his next show that we'll eventually get to, Gypsy, he was writing specifically for a performer, right?
Yes.
He's writing for Ethel Merman, which has kind of a specific style of way that she likes to sing songs. But even his biggest hit of all time, which I always think is hilarious, is Send in the Clowns.
Yeah.
Was written late in the show because of the actress and like, we need a song for her in the second act. And that became like the biggest song that he's ever written in his entire life. I think this song overall fits in incredibly well. Like, I think we do need this introductory song for Tony. Interestingly enough, like, we meet Maria and she doesn't have a song when we first meet her. Her song comes later on in the show. Mm-hmm. But I think we do need to understand Tony because he's been talked about already by characters. We know he's somebody that Riff at least greatly admires. So I think we need him to really tell us, the audience, like, who are you? What kind of person are you? So that we can start to empathize with him and his journey.
Exactly. We don't get to see him in the Jet song dancing mm-hmm. with the rest of the Jets. So why should we care about him? Well, this song explains it.
Yeah.
And it lets us kind of set up that character development so that we care about him the rest of the song, which is super interesting that Sondheim didn't originally want to write the lyrics for the show.
All right.
He didn't want to do it. And he just wanted to be known as a composer and a lyricist, not just as a lyricist, and thought that he would be pigeonholed into this lyricist position. So isn't it so interesting that we now regard it as one of the musical theater canon's greatest works?
Yeah. I think what it really shows is how collaboration can really pay off. I think that the lyrics that Stephen Sondheim writes, but also the music that Leonard Bernstein writes, really complement each other so incredibly well. They worked really, really great as a team. I'm curious then, so you went to Missouri State College, correct? What was your biggest takeaway from going there? I mean, having never been there before you went there, what did you expect and what did you actually get?
Sure. I think the biggest thing, and this is partly coming from that workshop class where I worked on Some Things Coming, as well as some other Sondheim pieces like Everybody Says Don't. And I think my biggest takeaway is that everything that an actor does has to have an action tied to it. Mm-hmm. And I had worked on it a little bit before. I mean, it comes from originally Stanislavski technique. But taking it a step further, when we say something in everyday life, we're not just saying words for the sake of saying words, right? We're saying them to try to get something, to try to do something, right? If I say to someone that's walking down the street with their face buried in their cell phone, I mean, like, watch out. I'm not just saying the words, watch out. What am I actually trying to do? I'm trying to save them from the impending doom of this bus coming towards them, right? I know it's a silly example, but every word that is spoken in our everyday life has an action attached to it, right? We have an intention for everything. Mm. And so a lot of my time in school was spent taking every single song, every single script, and scoring out and figuring out what action is applied for every single thing, because honestly, every single sentence, you can even dive into every single word having its own separate action. And so that's the subtext behind what an actor is saying. That's a subtext behind what each of us says every single day. Subtext is in absolutely everything. And so how do we write that in a way that that's what we're thinking when we're saying the line? I think as an actor, that's probably the way that I developed the most and had a lot of opportunities to play a character completely different to myself. And how do you do that? Well, subtext and actions are going to take you most of the way to do that. So that's a big thing. Of course, I had a wonderful voice teacher, Dr. Paulus Patterson, who also allowed me to grow vocally. And of course, I got an opportunity to work on dance technique as well. But I think the biggest thing, and that's a large focus, probably the biggest focus, arguably, of that musical theater program, was developing actors who can sing rather than singers who can act. And so I think that was the biggest takeaway I had from working at MSU.
Oh, that's great. I mean, I'm a little bit biased. I have actually seen you perform in the past. So I've definitely seen...
That was a Sondheim show as well, right?
That was Assassins. Yeah. That I saw you in, which was a great show. The last thing I just wanted to mention here is we've kind of danced around it a little bit in that this is one person on stage mm-hmm. or one person on screen. And so all that movement and all that kind of stuff that you're talking about of interpreting the lyrics and the music that's happening has to be done by one person. It's not like a chorus behind you. There's no kick line or anything that's coming out on stage. So you have to act this by yourself, kind of center stage going on. So all of this work in the background really needs to be there. So
absolutely.
Instead of just standing there, not moving, and then just singing the song, which mm-hmm. I don't think would carry the same weight in this case.
Correct. But in the same way, if you try to just fill it and you try to say, oh, okay, I'm singing this song alone for 2.5 minutes. I need to have these grandiose gestures and I need to gesture and look really excited. And it's going to come across completely fake and people are going to be even more bored than if you had just done nothing.
Right,
so I think that's why the prep work is so important to creating a believable experience, especially when it's a soliloquy.
Mm-hmm. Well, Nick, thank you so much for coming out here and talking to me.
My pleasure.
If people wanted to, is there an easy way for people to find you online?
Yes, nickdriscoll.com or on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, at Nick Driscoll. It's going to be the easiest way. Somehow I managed to scoop up all the good domain
Apparently.
Names and handles. So that's how way to find me.
We all hate you for it. again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kyle.
I thought that conversation was great. Thanks for listening. If you also enjoyed what you just heard, I need to be that annoying guy who asks you to go and rate and review this show on whichever platform you use. Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and all the other ones. It really helps out new podcasts. Also, if you have a Sondheim lover in your life, tell them about the show. You can share individual episodes or text them or just call them on the phone. Any help is greatly appreciated. A big thank you to the always great Chris Taniguchi, who designed the podcast artwork, and to Nick Driscoll for not only being this week's guest, but also for composing our theme music. If you're listening in the launch week, there was 3 episodes that published simultaneously, so you can enjoy the other 2 right now. But for now, we've come to the end of our episode. Yes, I know. Goodbye for now.